The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Paul and Robin, and on today's show, we'll relish in a new perspective on the purple plum tree, begin our focused look on pest and disease management, and tackle the challenge of weeds without resorting to harmful herbicides. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Hanahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. HanaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Edible Hawaiian Islands is a subscription-based, advertiser-supported print and digital magazine, the only James Beard Award-winning food and drink magazine in the state of Hawaii. Edible Hawaiian Islands digital magazine may be enjoyed at ediblehi.com.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, my friend Paul.
How are you this fine day?
Most excellent. It's so beautiful. Every day has been like a holiday.
How about those blue skies this morning? Crisp, clear, beautiful, heavenly.
Mm-hmm.
We truly live heaven on earth locale here. Heavenly for gardeners, heavenly for farmers.
Indeed.
Well, we have a chock-a-block full show today. Full of plenty of good content for you guys, and hopefully you'll come away with some great useful information for your gardening and farming activities. And we will begin with our celestial session, looking to the heavenly bodies above for inspiration, guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming activities. And today's Hawaiian moon phase, brought to us by the Hanalei Moon and Tide calendar, today's Hawaiian moon is Akua. And Akua is in the second Anahulu, or Hawaiian moon week, called Poi Poi, which means rounding or full. And indeed, this is a very round, very full moon. Akua rose, will rise over Kauai this evening at 7:18 p.m. She will reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 1 a.m. tomorrow morning, and she'll set at 6:43 a.m. on Thursday tomorrow. 99% of the moon's face is calculated to be visible, according to the U.S. Naval Observatory. And full moon will occur exactly, precisely today at 4:20.
Excellent.
So you gotta love that. And Akua, it's the 14th night in the Hawaiian moon month. Akua, meaning god, goddess, spirit, ghost, devil, image, idol, corpse, divine, supernatural, godly. Akua might mate with humans and give birth to normal humans, mo'o or kupua, which are demigods. Akua is also a banana variety. And, boy, we've been eating the LALA banana lately, and it's so delicious.
Mm.
And we will let you know as well that the traditional wisdom for planting on this day, or this evening, I should say, when Akua rises, kalo, taro, uala, sweet potato, mai'a, banana, and corn as well. And we have a corn farmer in studio today. Very excited to be sharing that with our good buddy Ken Lindsay. But for now, we're going to jump over to the biodynamic information.
That's right. The moon is in the ascending inflection right now, so we're working with the upper sides of the plant. Wednesday, today, the moon in Sagittarius, a fire sign, which typically would be good for our fruiting plants. However, flower is recommended, and that is due to light trines. So three planets in air or fire signs trining up together are going to give us this flower recommendation through pretty much the entire early end of July here, all peaking out on the Wednesday, the 15th, the third of the three trines, making it probably the best fruit and flower planting time of our year this year. So giving you a little heads up notice on that, because maybe you've been thinking, oh geez, with all those mangoes coming around market and whatnot, that you might want to have one of those in your yard. Well, we've got a stellar aspects going for tree planting, fruit and flower trees on July 15th. So giving you a heads up so you can get prepared for that, because you know, sometimes we need to make preparations. It's not as easy as it sounds to plant a fruit tree properly. Tomorrow, moon still in Sag, although it is fruit that is recommended in that fire sign. Friday, the moon moving into Capricorn, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants, but only until about noon. And from noon Friday through Saturday and Sunday, we're looking at fairly unproductive times for planting in the biodynamic calendar. So if you've been looking to take a weekend off, it is July 4th this weekend. Maybe you want to go out and celebrate our interdependence with your friends and family. That would be an excellent time to do that. Monday, moon in Pisces, a water sign, making it typically a good time for leaf plants, but here comes the flower recommendation once again. We've got so much light and warmth energies here in the beginning of July that we're going to take advantage of those. And Tuesday next, moon still in Pisces, although leaf plants are recommended for this time. So just that heads up on those beautiful trines that are happening. Also, just want to note the incredible conjunction of Venus and Jupiter that's been visible in the night sky for a while now, but it's gotten closer and closer and closer. Technically, yesterday was supposed to be the actual conjunction. I looked at it and thought, well, there's room for them to get just maybe a little bit closer before they pass. But as we know, nothing out there stays stable, and they're going to keep moving all day long, even while we can't see them. So we'll see tonight, I guess, what happens if they're still so close to each other.
And when they're conjunct, do we see them overlap each other? Or
what I understood was that they would look like a double star. They'd be close enough that it looked like a double star. Yeah. But last night there was a fair amount of gap in there that they looked like two distinct stars to me. However, last night was slated that it was the closest they would get. So maybe one of those planets might go into retrograde and start to move away, or I'm not exactly sure on the detail there. But either way, we're just looking at some great planting times here in the beginning of July, and so fun to be eaten out of the garden. That gets me out there to do the work that's necessary when I get to go out every day and harvest some dinner.
I love it. I love your enthusiasm, and we have a lot to share with you today in that realm. And we're going to look at some notable news right now, which hopefully will get some people heaving somewhat of a sigh of relief, or at least feeling a bit more hopeful or optimistic about the soil beneath their feet that may, depending on previous land use, be contaminated. But some new research, and this thanks to ScienceDaily.com, a story entitled, "With Proper Care, Contaminated Urban Soils Are Safe for Gardening," the study finds. So crops grown in contaminated urban soils present little or no risk for people eating those crops when gardeners have followed best practices, or so shows a six-year study. The study looked at the bioavailability of the contaminants, not just what's in the soil, but what's getting picked up by the plants themselves, how much of these contaminants might be absorbed by the food being grown. Contaminants looked at in the study include many of the ones that we have, that we face as potentially toxic here in our soils, including lead, arsenic, zinc, as well as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, often referred to as PAHs.
Well, those don't sound very delicious.
They are not delicious. They're often byproducts of fossil fuel combustion. Seem like a lot of them came from coal tar and things that fall on our soils. So the lead researcher here, Ganja Hetarachichi, an associate professor of soil and environmental chemistry at Kansas State University, and her team showed that only root crops showed contaminant uptake at levels warranting concern, and even then, the amount was low, and it was suggested that only if you ate them every day would you be concerned about the about what was in there. And so if you're eating then leafy tops and fruits, it's much less of an uptake. And this is all based, though, on following best management practices, which would be taking a soil test to make sure they're not completely off the Richter scale, raising your soil pH, supplying adequate nutrients, so the plants are more likely to uptake the bad chemicals if they don't have a ready source of nutrients, so always going back to that good soil fertility management. That is true especially of the phosphorus levels. Soils with low phosphorus, you're more likely to uptake your lead. And you want to use plenty of compost. And then as far as washing the vegetables, this is almost the most important part. Direct contact and consumption of contaminated soil or dust on the produce is likely to give the highest risk or be the highest risk part of eating veggies from contaminated soil. So don't forget to wash them well if you're in a soil of concern. And with all the other weird things that we can pick up, like the rat lungworm and other things, it's always a good idea to give your produce a good wash before you eat it. I know it's hard to do that when you're in the garden, but...
Sure, sure. Well, that must be music to Ron Finley's ears. I know we had him as a guest on the show well over a year ago now, and he's famous for planting the median strips there in Los Angeles, and I probably imagine how much exhaust contamination might be there, but that's great news, really.
Indeed it is. And we're excited right now to turn to our first guest on air. We're joined by Dr. Basco and Dr. Ihor Basco, a wonderful just contributor to our community here. He's a renowned veterinarian practicing acupuncture, herbal medicine, dietary therapy, homeopathy, massage, and other alternative therapies for animals, which is located at his clinic in Kapahi on Kauai'i's east side. Dr. Basco hosts the Pets, People, and Paradise radio show right here on KKCR, Saturday mornings from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m., and a wonderful wealth of information, and we're super grateful he took a few minutes to join us on the air today. Dr. B, are you with us?
Hey, aloha.
Aloha.
Yeah, I guess you were interested in the paper I'm doing on the purple Javanese plum that everybody swears when they park under that tree and the plum stains their car or clothes permanently, just the amount of that invasive species on this island just got me wondering, like, why is it here? Why are a lot of invasive species here and seem to be medicinal? Like, who planted them here and for what reason? So that has been an interest of mine for a while, because while we live on an island, you never know when we're going to be disconnected from the reality of the mainland by storms and who knows what. Yes. And there's so much here that we could use as medicine instead of buying drugs. For instance, the Java plum.
Yes.
Can basically cure and treat most of the diseases that afflict the Hawaiian people living here, and even worldwide. Obesity, cancer, we're always worried about radiation, protects against radiation, diarrhea, it's an antifungal. You see a lot of trees dying from fungal diseases around the Java plum. But the only thing you see with the Java plum is things are eating it, bugs are eating it, but not fungus, because it's an antifungal, antibacterial, and it's really a great plant. All parts of that tree are medicinal, so it's been blowing my mind. And I've been working on diabetes for pets. How can we do that naturally without a lot of drugs? Insulin injections is not the easiest way for the average person to do and monitor blood glucose by poking the pad or the ear and getting a drop of blood twice a day. I mean, that's not really practical for the average person. But if we can prevent diabetes or use something natural, which is what I'm working on right now, and it's just an amazing plant.
I'm surprised that diabetes, on the one hand, is so prevalent in our pets as well as humans. I know my mom has now a second dog that she's giving daily insulin shots to. But when I think about the foods that we share and the decline in the nutrition of food for humans, I suppose the same decline has been occurring for the ingredients that are used in pet food, too.
Well, it's basically what you guys know. Processed foods do not work. And basically, that is the basic problem with humans. We eat a lot of processed foods. And in doing some research on the trends, more and more people are losing the ability to know how to cook food, believe it or not. I know on Kauai maybe that's different, but usually people go out to eat all the time and they have no idea what they're eating, but as long as it tastes good and the price is right, they keep on eating. And so with dog food and cat food, there's just a high amount of processed carbohydrates, which the cat, for instance, should not be eating dry food because they don't even have the enzymes for carbs. And they're basically meat eaters. And the dog, the same thing. I mean, you can overload with carbs by just feeding dry food and not exercising enough. But after a while, the pancreas, which secretes the insulin, gets either, one, worn out, and can't produce enough insulin, so that's one kind of diabetes, or the sugar in the blood has been so high for so very long that even with insulin injections, the body is not utilizing the insulin to force the glucose to go to the cells to feed the body naturally. And so then you have this problem where even insulin at a certain point quits working.
Hmm. Frightening. So let's get back to the Java plum, and no doubt people have it somewhere nearby, especially if you live in some of the drier regions of the island. And is it the fruit that's used primarily, or are we using the leaf? What are we after?
Well, in the studies from India and Pakistan and Brazil, they make a powder out of the seed, okay, and then they produce it into a product that's available in a powder or pill form. So the seed seems to have the most of it, but also the leaves and the fruit. So if you were to make a jam, for instance, or a drink like a juice
or wine,
hot summers, or wine, I'm not successful with the wine, but I made great balsamic vinegar with it. It's just the best stuff. I just drink it out of the bottle, keep it in the fridge, and it just tastes really good. But the fruit itself, not only does it have anti-diabetic properties, which means it lowers your blood glucose and stimulates some insulin, so it'd be a good drink to eat with your chocolate cake or whatever carb you love. And also, it has those anthocyanidins, which are anti-cancer. They've done studies on breast cancer, so it seems like it's a good breast cancer preventative. And even in India, used as a treatment for breast cancer, the Java plum fruit.
Far out. So what would we be looking at as far as a dosage goes, Doc?
Well, that's a good point. Well, I've been working on that for animals, but the dosages are basically about, if you made the juice from the plant, if you had just a half a cup with each meal, that would help a lot. So if you just put, you can boil the fruit and then make that into a juice and keep it in the fridge, or you can just juice it, got to take the pit out, and just juice it in your juicer and just do it raw, either way is going to work because of the anthocyanidins. But I think raw would be better than boiled or cooked.
Sure, it seems like it. The properties would remain.
Yeah, most of them would. And then making the seed, I mean, really, I'm looking at creating a product for pets, working with a company on the mainland. And I see all these herbs that are, you know, basically imported from India or China. Why couldn't we have a business here of selling the seeds and then processing the seeds by drying them? And then, and you can find all this information on Scholar Google, how to dry them, how to process them, make them into a powder, and then sell them to a company that wants to make a metabolic product that lowers blood glucose. The fruit would be more labor intensive because you'd have to freeze dry it and then sell it that way as a freeze dried product, but seems like the seed would be an easy thing. So that could be a business for someone.
No doubt. We're always looking for entrepreneurial opportunities around here. And really, in a lot of ways, this seems like a win on all sides, because if folks did want to harvest the fruits earnestly, there'd be less seeds out there to be germinating and growing, that the birds would be spreading into potentially native plant reserves and things like that, where we wouldn't necessarily want the Java plum to be invading.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of a population control thing at the same time.
Yeah, if you utilize the fruit for yourself and save the seeds and then found a way to process the seeds so they could be exported to the mainland, there's many companies that would be interested to buy the stuff. You'd have to make, you know, you have to sell it by maybe 20 kilos at a time, which is what they usually order, 20 kilos at a time when they're making a product. Mm-hmm.
So the fruiting period, where we, if we wanted the fruit or the seeds, from my observation, has been more in sort of the late fall to early winter time. But any time of year, obviously, the trees have the leaves on them, and I've certainly enjoyed chewing on the leaves of the Java plum. What sort of ailment was I curing myself of by doing that?
Well, if you have bacteria, pathogenic bacteria like staph, strep, pseudomonas, clostridium, or candida, that's great to make a mouthwash. In fact, the oil from the leaves is showed activity against pseudomonas, which is really hard to get out of a mouth or a dog's ear, E. coli, and staph, which is everywhere, candida, salmonella. I mean, really, the oil, if you know how to extract oils, that would be another product right there, is to either, you're chewing on the leaves, or you're getting the oil in your mouth. The benefits of the leaves are also anti-cancer, anti-diabetic, protects you from radiation from Fukushima or PMRF or who knows what, sun radiation. So it's your natural ability to connect with plants kind of attracted you to start chewing on the leaves. And perhaps maybe you have dental problems, I don't know, but it would definitely help your mouth.
I noticed in your paper, Doc, that you also said it could be effective at removing heavy metals. So was there a particular part of the plant that you found would be valuable for that? Because I know quite a number of people who go through the heavy metal detox, and you know, it can be pretty hard on the body, even just detoxing from those heavy metals.
Yeah. In studies in India, they did Java plum bark, mango bark, and neem bark to see which of the three trees would be the best for heavy metals, because in those third world countries, pollution is a big deal of water. So there is a way to process the bark so you can actually get rid of the whole, process the whole tree. You can process the bark and make a water filter out of it, where your water is sifted through the bark, and of all those plants that they tested, the Java plum bark scored the best, and that research was just done in 2012. So if we had to make a water filter because of whatever, we didn't have any filters, this could be one of the things one of the trees. We could use a combination of trees, but that one would be the bark, would be what you would use to get to trap the heavy metals out of the water.
Incredible. Well, I'm looking out the window at the KKCR studio right now, and the tree that I see in the beautiful sunlight is indeed a Java plum tree. And I'm looking forward to, as soon as the show's over, I'm going to go over and pick some leaves and check on, see if any flowers are starting to develop. I know you have a lot of Java plum in your neighborhood. Are you going to begin, or have you already begun to make some products for your use in your veterinary practice?
Well, I'm going to test it out on my friends who have issues with their, like, cat stomatitis, where the gums are inflamed, and not only are they infected with strep and other bacteria, but after they go to the regular veterinarian, they get antibiotics, so then the antibiotics kill the bacteria. But then what happens with antibiotics? The yeast in the mouth starts to grow, the pathogenic yeast. So this would be something that would do both. The yeast that's pathogenic and the strep, and making it into a mouthwash.
Wow. That's incredible. I am so grateful that you've looked into this. I mean, it's such a pervasive, abundant plant on the island, and to know that it has such a positive use for us all is just excellent.
Yeah, and there's so many other plants here. There's like Chinese plants that I use in my Chinese remedies that I buy from either China or Canada or the mainland, and a lot of the Chinese plants, maybe because Chinese people were here at one time early and they didn't have drugs in the 1800s, whatever, and they brought their medicinal plants here, and now they're all over everywhere. Like Gotu-Kola, which is another one.
Thank goodness. Well, thank you so much for contributing to our Medicine Chest segment, and it'd be great to have you join us again. I know you have a wealth of information about so many of our plants, and we do want to let folks know, or remind folks, that you have your very own radio program, and I want to say personally that you've really inspired both Robin and myself to bring our show up to the next level by providing so much useful information. You really were the model for our latest version of The Garden Show, so thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much for being there, because I love your show, too.
Thank you.
Great. Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye. Aloha.
Aloha. That was Dr. Vasco, and you can find out more information about all his work at drbasco.com, drbasko.com.
Excellent.
And this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio, and with your hosts Robin and Paul. And right now, we are super stoked to introduce our in-studio guest. He was with us just kind of a short while ago, but we tempted him out of the field again. I'm not sure what we tempted him with, other than, hey buddy, can you help us out? But
Lunch.
We are that's right, Ludge. We're joined by our good buddy Ken Lindsay. Ken has been a successful market garden farmer on Kauai for the past 5 years, establishing and operating farms in Kalaheo, Puhi, Molawa'a, and Kalihiwai. Though he worked for one of the big seed companies on the west side for 2 years, he is now firmly dedicated to ecological and organic methodology. Ken is both formally and practically trained in plant science, and brings that combination of perspective to our discussion today about integrated pest management. So, welcome, Ken. It's great to have you back in.
Thanks.
Yeah, we're so excited. We're starting off our month-long feature on the happy topic of pest and disease management. So, as you know, we've been going through the whole process of starting a nice fat garden, and inevitably you're going to meet some pests. And I found that right about this hot time in the summer, when the weather changes, the plants can get a little bit stressed out at that point. And to me, that's when those pests seem to rear their ugly heads. You know, it's kind of, I think of it like our own immune system. We're in contact with so many germs all day, every day, and our immune system is up there and it's humming. But when something happens, we catch a chill or we have too late a night or whatever it is, and our immunity dips down for just a minute, then it's so easy to catch something. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I see it with the plants, too.
Yeah. Integrated pest management, or IPM, is the shortened version of that. It seems to me that when you look at some of the big chemical farming operations in general, if they're big enough, they're going to have an IPM sort of person who's in charge of that, or even a division. And it seems like it always goes down to, what does that person or what does that division do? Is that they spray pesticides. That's really the solution, but that's not the idea behind integrated pest management. It's about taking all kinds of steps and using something like a spray as the last option. And Ken, I know you have a lot of experience seeing both well-applied IPM and not so well-applied IPM. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, I think IPM starts with healthy plants, because if you don't have healthy plants, they're going to be way more prone to get sick. And it seems like the way to grow healthy plants is to put everything in the soil in the right combination to grow healthy plants. If you don't do that, you're already off on the wrong foot.
What sort of things?
All the major micronutrients. Yeah, that's, and in the right proportion too, and just making sure the soil's balanced. Because it seems like when the plants have everything they need to stay healthy and, you know, keep themselves, just like us, you know, we need to have a healthy diet, otherwise we get sick. So if the plants don't have the building blocks they need to stay healthy, then they're going to be way more prone to getting sick.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell people what sort of method you use to determine what you need and then how to apply it?
Yes, soil test. You know, just get a good soil test and take their recommendations and put it in, you know, and that seems to make all the difference. I've seen, since I've gotten more on board with that, I've seen a huge decrease in my pest and disease problems to where I don't even spray. Like, I think I sprayed one time in the last 4 months, you know. There just hasn't been the need. I'm trying to work with other techniques, too, to avoid spraying, but spraying should always be the last line of defense, for sure.
Sure. Along with, you know, preparing the soil perfectly, I found, I think what my issue was, because I'm dealing with some pest issues in my garden right now, is they got dried out. They got stressed for water because my irrigation was kind of tuned up for spring, and it was a little rainier. Maybe we were getting night rains, and then the plants, I think, were not being well irrigated, and when they dry out a little bit, they can go into stress mode and get attractive. So not just soil prep, but I think proper irrigation plays into those healthy plants too.
So when you worked previously for one of those big agrochemical corporations, it seems like a big company like that with so much a wealth of resources, should we say, that they could, you know, afford to do any kind practices necessary, and yet you were telling me that some of the observations you were making in the field were showing that success was not being achieved. What were you observing, and what do you suppose, what sort of mistakes do you suppose were being made in those kind of systems?
I think it all goes back to the soil prep. Like, when they're feeding the plants, they're just using the big three, you know, NPK, and they kind of just really pump those all the time. So the plants don't have access to all the things that they need. And like, when you're going to go out and determine, you know, what to do, like, to see if you have pests is scouting, you know. So you always want to go out and scout the field and see what kind of pest you're dealing with. And there's always going to be, you know, certain pests that affect a certain crop, you know, more or less. There's very few pests that jump species, you know, crop species. So, and it's usually at a certain stage of the plant, too. Like, you're not going to go out and look for aphids usually when the plants are small. It's more like when the ears develop. And you're not going to go out and look for earworm, you know, when the plants are small. But you might look for, like, leafhoppers when the plants are small in the whorls. So a lot of times, if you don't get it early enough, then that problem is just going to keep growing and growing. And when you grow year-round and you're growing crops right next to each other in succession, it's so much easier for pests just to jump, you know, from field to field while you're spraying, too. So if you're not, then you just get in this constant loop of, you know, spraying, 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 because if you don't, you're going to lose everything. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to do a scouting form for those guys, most of the times it would be like 10, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 how bad it is, it'd be a 10, 10, 10, you know, for many things. And then now growing corn organically, and when the plants do have access to all the minerals, it's like almost a zero for everything. There's nothing out in the field now that I really worry about or that has any economic impact on the crop.
And yet if you grew hundreds of acres of corn after corn after corn after corn, even organically, you'd be inviting those pests in, yeah?
Yeah, that's a big X factor now, just to see what happens when you keep doing it over and over. But we're not going to grow corn through the winter time, whereas they do. And they do try to do a good job of moving everything to the South Shore in the summertime to kind of help break that cycle. But it's still just so much corn all the time that it's really, and then you're going to get, you know, resistance to different sprays too. And it's just, yeah, it's never ending. You know, yeah.
You were describing to me the difference between harvesting your beautiful organic corn you guys have been harvesting up there at the farm this summer as compared to the description. I was wondering if you could share about harvesting the ears of corn out in one of these big conventionally grown plots out on the west side.
Yeah, the biggest thing, or two biggest things that come to mind would be aphids. They'll just coat the ear to where you almost can't even see the ear. Like, you grab it and it's just slimy with aphids. It's, you know, literally that bad. And also spider mites. You can walk through a field of corn and just, you'll walk out and you're just, you know, covered in little orange dots, and they're really hard to get off you, and they're just really annoying. And another one too is the earworm. Sometimes if you harvest an ear, you could pop it open, and there'll be almost, it'd be like 2-3 kernels on an ear just because they're so eaten out by it.
And this is even with the use of all of those restricted use pesticides, they still have these outbreaks?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can't really say what they're spraying all the time, but every corn harvest was pretty similar. You know, that you never got into a field where it was like, oh, this one's really clean and great, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
Poor practices. Well, another part of IPM is sanitation, right? And that's something we've been kind of hammering away at over the course of the last couple of months. But, you know, taking out the diseased stuff, right? Like not letting it hang around, removing it from the field. In some cases, it can be really important. I know we talked about the basal downy mildew. And, you know, if we're leaving the infected leaves down there, out there on the plants, it's very likely that it's going to spread to the whole plant and then from plant to plant to plant. And, you know, when we decided we were going to talk about this, I thought of two examples of plants here on the islands that quote, used to be so easy to grow that we could almost just grow them with, like, effortlessly. And one of them is basil. I mean, we just had shrubs in our yard, you know. It was, you could, like, take your basil totally for granted, and it would still be there for you. Another plant that comes to mind is bananas, because it used to be that you could just, you know, go harvest the bananas, cut up the trunk, maybe throw a little fertilizer at them once a year. But I've seen so many banana patches go down with bunchy top in the last year. It's really sad.
And a lot of other stuff, too, that you can't see as easily as the bunchy top, too, like the corm weevils and the nematodes.
Yeah, and so those two plants, I think, you know, we used to kind of get by with what I'd call benign neglect. But those days seem like they're over, and we really need to start paying more attention to our plantings. I mean, I love bananas. I'll be really sad that I don't have them in my yard anymore, you know. And it's like we can't just sort of let them go and do their thing anymore. We need to pay a lot more attention to how we're growing them.
I know that's been one of the concerns of commercial growers, is that if people have fruit trees, for instance, and they're neglecting them and they become a perfect host site for a pest that is, or disease that is specific to that crop, and then that's next to somebody's commercial crop, that's actually a reservoir that's not being treated. And so oftentimes commercial growers will discourage people to grow backyard trees unless they're taking really good care of them, which on the one hand doesn't seem really fair, because of course it's everybody's right to grow a fruit tree, but you can understand where the growers' heads are at with that too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have to say that the prevention equals monitoring equals observing, which is what you were saying, Ken, about scouting. You know, it's a really important part of the process in IPM is to get out there and see it and catch it early so you can treat it when it's treatable, before it's such a huge infestation that it's going to take more drastic measures, or that you might be affecting your neighbors adversely too.
Yeah. So, Ken, in regards to beneficial predator insects, when you're doing your scouting and observing on your farm, are you watching the lady beetles come in, for instance, and you just let them do their trick, or do you see that they're really making a substantial contribution to reducing pests, or what are you seeing?
I'd say the best example I could give right now would be in parsley. I've never seen parsley get taken down by root aphid before. Like, if you look at the root of the plant, it'll just be covered in aphids. I've never had that. And sure enough, you know, tons of ladybugs all over the parsley. And I let one row kind of go just to see what would happen. And I lost about half the plants, but then the other half are fine. You know, like, so it definitely, you know, kind of hit a peak. And then I'm guessing that the predator population got enough to actually wipe out a lot of the aphids. Because then I started to see them creep into other plants like, you know, carrots and cilantro, you know, similar, you know, closely related plants. So, and then I see them on the cilantro too now. So, but that it hasn't been to where it's taken down cilantro like it has the parsley. So it does seem like it increased the population, and now the root aphid problem's going away.
Yeah, I know those predators can come in such numbers. Well, I have a little example that I'm not terribly proud of, actually, but I do want to share it because I think it's a good learning experience that I learned a lot from it, and maybe you guys will too. I had two beautiful roselles growing in my garden last year, and this happens to me. I live in such a dry part of the island, and I don't keep up when I know I should turn my irrigation up, or I don't realize I should turn my irrigation up, and the plants are getting dried out, and suddenly there was like a lot of aphids on my roselles, like way more. I mean, if I would have caught it earlier, I could have used some soap and probably taken care of the problem, but I didn't, and I saw it, but I didn't treat it, and I let it go, and then it was like so bad, but I didn't want to lose my roselles, that I busted out like the big guns, which to me, Pyganic, and that's part of IPM too, is spraying is the last resort, right? So Pyganic is pretty strong stuff. It's a broad spectrum pesticide, so it takes out beneficial insects as well as bad ones. And about a week later, really close by on a mango tree, I saw a very beat up looking praying mantis trying to lay like sort of a deformed embryo pod on the tree. And I realized in that moment that I had probably sprayed this poor praying mantis with the Pyganic. He was probably out there munching on aphids, and I didn't look very close. And, you know, the pod never hatched, and I'm sure that the praying mantis didn't make it, and I felt really terrible that I'd, like, taken out a beneficial. I mean, praying mantises aren't the most common beneficial insect around. You know, I see maybe two or three per year, and I'm always excited when I see them, and I felt really terrible that I had, like, let it go that far. And that in my treatment of just trying to save my roselles, that I took down, you know, beneficial insect. So getting out there in early detection, you know, really observing our plants in the most deepest sense, not being distracted. You're not talking on the phone while you're scouting, right? You're just down there checking it out. And with root aphids, I mean, you're down on the ground because you can see the plant's not happy, and then you have to go deeper. Why is the plant not happy? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We're here with you until 1 p.m., at which time Tracy's going to roll in for Kauai Vibrations from 1 to 3, 3 to 5, Shaka Kayaka with the Papule Show, and 5 o'clock, Scott Majerus with Surf Stories, and plenty more great programming coming up for the rest of the day and the rest of the week. If you want to see the schedule for KKCR, go to kkcr.org and check out the calendar. We're here with you each and every Wednesday talking about gardening and farming issues. We're joined right now by Ken Lindsay, North Shore Farmer, organic through and through, and really showing us that with proper soil management and other best management practices, we can avoid our pest and disease management issues. And one of the things, Ken, that we talk about on the show a lot is variety selection. And I know you have tried out a lot. You've seen what works, what doesn't, based on the season. And when it comes to pest and disease management, how much, when you're sitting down with the catalog and you're choosing your varieties, of course you're thinking taste and yield and lots of things, but how much is pest and disease resistance part of your selection criteria?
It could be more, but I think generally just get comfortable with growing the ones that you're used to. And pretty... you could do everything right and still get pests and diseases. It just seems like sometimes it's just the right combination of variables that will bring it in, you know, and then a week later it could be gone. Like a good example, say, white rust on arugula. I had maybe four crops in a row get taken down by it, or it wasn't even worth harvesting. And then all of a sudden, next week, the new planting, couldn't find it on there. Like, not one. You know, and that's a big problem. So it can take, you know, quadruple the time to harvest if you're trying to still pull it off. Right. It takes it from it being, like, a really quick, easy crop to being not even worth the time, you know? But, and I've tried other arugula varieties, but it seems like if it's going to hit it, it's going to hit it, you know? Mm. A good example of what I'm doing right now for trying different varieties is a straight neck yellow squash. It's powdery mildew resistant. It seemed like you see that a lot more offered in seed catalogs now. So powdery mildew on cucurbits is going to be the thing that takes it down. Well, as far as the disease goes, it's going to be what takes your plants down here almost every time, you know. And I'm looking forward to trying that out to see how resistant it really is. And since it's an OP, it may be possible to, you know, do selection on those, doing the seed work, and keep finding the ones that have the greatest resistance to the powdery mildew. Because without it, you can pull it off, but you're going to get, you know, maybe a quarter or half the crop of what you'd want to get before the plants just stop, they shut down and stop producing. And then if you don't get them early enough, now you're creating this huge reservoir of powdery mildew that's just going to spread and spread and spread.
Yeah, and choosing your timing right on a crop like that, too, is like in the driest part of the summer. Certainly not something you'd want to plant in December when it's raining every day, yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing I want to try working with more, too, is just grow small plots of every plant throughout the year to really tune into when things come in and, you know, when they don't, and see if that's really a big problem, you know, because I don't know right now, just because sometimes you don't grow everything all year, you know, for certain reasons, but it'll be interesting to see in the next year doing that.
Sure, yeah. Give it a try, because those anomalies of weather do come around. A couple of years ago, I remember Ray Maquis had like that incredible watermelon crop in like November. It was pretty fantastic.
Yeah. Well, Ken, you mentioned bringing plants to seed and doing some selections on that powdery mildew-resistant squash. And I thought that was a good segue opportunity to mention the multiple seed crop project that I'm very happy to be doing with you this summer. And wondering if you can tell people about it and express our need, desire for some intern help with that.
Yeah, we're just going to try to create more of a procedure to grow multiple seeds from multiple crops and things that we grow most of the time or most market gardeners grow, because people do grow seed and a lot of people do a good job with that, but some of the critical pieces of that get overlooked, just like the population size and isolation, just to make sure that you're retaining the genetic integrity of the seed, and then also that it's not going to get crossed with anything that you don't want it to get crossed with. Like if you're going to grow one variety of plant, you want to make sure that all the pollinations in that group of plants are by that variety and not another one. It's okay to cross things if you're intending to do that, but when you're doing this kind of work, you don't want to do that. So we're just really trying to describe a way to grow all these seeds the right way, you know, so that you can stand behind your seed then, know that it was done right, and you can give it to people and know what it was, and that when they plant that out, they're going to be starting from a great place too, instead of giving them something that you're not 100% sure about.
Right. Yes, and in terms of what we need, when we need it, and where we need it, how soon do we need help?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Yeah. So basically, can you describe a bit of the steps of the process of what's going to happen?
Yeah, from a field standpoint, you know, first you got to pick out where you're going to do it, and then how much land you're going to open up, and that's depends on how many crops you're going to grow and how much space you need for each crop. So for our project, after going through all the information on how much space you need for each crop, we opened up an eighth of an acre. It seemed to be the smallest that we can do. It's the right size for the amount of time that we have and the amount of resources we have. And it's going to be enough to allow us to grow all these crops to seed the right way. So then after that, we opened it up And now the biggest problem would be, or the thing that needs the most attention right now is pulling nut grass. I'm sure anyone who's grown any garden on Kauai is familiar with a nut sedge. And it's so critical to get it out of the field before you do anything. Because if you try to fertilize and water loose soil, it's just like you're going to be growing nut grass. And it's best to get it out 3 weeks from the time that you start seeing it. Like, we can start at it now, but after about 3 weeks, then it seems to start spreading. And you want to get it when you have the least amount of nuts in the field, because as soon as they start spreading, then you're already creating more work for yourself.
Right.
So then once we're going to pull all the nut sedge out, any other grasses that grow back, and then probably disc it again to get any broadleaf annuals that are there before they start to seed. And then I'll just kill those and then maybe do one more nut grassing before we spread amendments. And then once we spread amendments, it'll be shake beds and throw in irrigation and plant.
Awesome. Well, we are doing this process up in Kalihiwai. And yes, it's like tomorrow or the next day we're going to be on it. We want to invite people to jump in. And Ken and I will both be there. We have lots of information to share about this process of growing seeds. We're still learning, but we have a bit of experience already under our belts, and this is an opportunity for organic seed production really to take off. We're collaborating with the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative, a statewide effort, and so it's really almost maybe the birth of the organic seed industry here in the Hawaiian Islands. So we're really excited, and we want to invite you to be in touch with us. And I'll throw out my number, 652-4118, if you would like to get involved. We will be doing lots of different steps, and it's a lot of fun. I saw you out there working the nut grass in your field this morning.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a yoga-like process, so lots of great exercise and so much time to talk in the field and learn. So
yeah, and instant friends out there while you're doing it.
Yes.
You know, before we head into our next segment and our final segment, we did have a caller from Wailua, Debbie. I just want to let people know she's basically telling us that bananas have a very aggressive pest right now, which is pigs. And that pigs are actually coming to eat the trunks of the trees for water, and was attacked by a pig while harvesting bananas. So this sounds like a terrible story, Debbie. I'm very sad to hear that. In a couple of weeks on the show, we're going to be covering non-insect pests of our plantings here in Hawaii, and so we'll definitely look into that and include some more information about pigs as one of the probably largest, most destructive pests that I can think of to our crops. But thanks for phoning in with that story. And we'll just move right along into weed control without poisons. Kind of a pet topic of mine, too. Certainly, integrated weed management is IWM, we'll coin it right here. And there's plenty of ways to take care of weed problems in your garden that don't include chemicals. And a couple that I can think of right off the top of my head is, of course, my hands, for starters. And then if that gets a little laborious, I'll put a sickle in the hand or maybe even a hoe in the hand, and that's another way. There's flamers. There's flame weeders that are non-poisonous.
I have been using one of those lately.
Yes, tell us about it.
It's fun, but it also seems kind of strange aiming petroleum-based product at the ground.
Sure.
So it's still, it's a mechanical means of killing the weed, but ultimately I felt like digging it up would have felt a little bit more eco-friendly.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I can relate, and I'll share a little bit of that in a minute, but if we want to get to not even having to pull weeds, and we want to look at what the weeds are doing, the weeds are trying to cover up the bare soil, right? That's why they're growing. So if we cover up the bare soil before they do with some kind of mulching material, that can be really effective. mulching, I know, brings its own challenges depending on your climate and exactly where you live. If you've got chickens around, they're going to come to it. Slugs like to hang out and mulch too sometimes, so some in certain applications, I'd say mulch is almost, you know, it's dual. Maybe the bad points of it outweigh what good it might be doing. But weeds are kind of fascinating, and I'm reading this book right now that I really want to just throw the title out there to our listeners, because I'm finding it really interesting. It's called Plants, Man, and Life, and it's by Edgar Anderson. And basically, a little teaser is we know less about the evolution of the weedy species of plants that have traveled with us all over the world than we do about, you know, the rarest plants in the world, say high alpine rock roses that grow only in one mountain peak in the Alps. You know, they're somehow way more appealing for taxonomists and scientists to go check out. But the hybridization of the weed species that live with us and have traveled with us has actually created so many new varieties of weeds that, taxonomically speaking, we don't really know what they are anymore. There's so many combinations of them out there, and to me, weeds are just a constant source of interest, because I know deep down somewhere that what weeds are growing on the soil, it tells us about what's in our soil, what's happening with the nutrients. And there's hardly any science really done on that specific topic of, you know, this kind of weed means there's excess iron in the soil or something like this. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But on the note of using a product, I do want to say that I have experimented with a product, believe it or not. It's called Avenger, and it is pure limonene oil from orange peels. And it is a non-selective burn-down type of herbicide. It's not like I'd want to use it in my garden or around my garden at all, or wood, but in gravel, along gravel driveways, or in rock walls, or weeds that want to come out of sidewalks, things like that, I think it can save a lot of time and energy. And
and you experienced success with one of the most fearsome weeds that
we have
to deal with, yes?
I did. I had a kind of a swaley zone that was just full-blown guinea grass, full seed production, 6 feet high, and with about four applications of this stuff, I killed the guinea grass. Mm-hmm. I was really impressed. I mean, first time it just burned it down, it sprouted up again, and then you start hitting that new growth, and this limonene oil took care of it, and I was pretty stoked. Now, there's recommendations about it. It's not available anywhere on Kauai, unfortunately, right now. Perhaps I might know someone who has a little. People could call the station if they wanted more info on that. But you basically, this kind of product you want to use in the full sun, in the middle of the hottest, driest day. You don't use it when it's raining, when the plant's already been rained on. That's how it works the best. I mean, it just pretty much desiccates out the leaves. And for plants like guinea grass, if you've got a big section of it, and if you have any, you know, small holder land, guinea grass can be such a big deal. And digging it out by hand is hard. It's hard work.
Really? So in addition, just in closing, Ken, you told us already about pulling the nut grass and the timing, the importance on that. When you're actually in production in the fields, do you spend a lot of time weeding? Or I know you're so good at your plant spacing, and you do use some other kind of mulches that keep your weeding to a minimum, but do you have a critical time that you do hoeing or other weed management strategies?
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot harder with direct-seeded crops, especially ones like carrots that take a long time, because then you might take two weedings as opposed to one. It always depends on the type of weeds that you have. I feel like in Kalihiwai, there's ones that I haven't dealt with before, and that can totally change the way that you approach it. But, yeah, for the most part, if you do your pre-weed control before you plant, then there should be a lot less to deal with. Anything that is left to deal with, usually if you hit it around, like, 2 to 3 weeks after germination, right before the plants are big enough to where they can take, you know, you being in the row and working with it, and then also at a time when the weeds are still small enough to where you can kill them really easy, like with a hula hoe, then the plants, if you get the timing right, the plants will then have all this extra space and then overgrow and create that living mulch effect if you do your spacing right. And then that should be enough to cruise on until you harvest, and then you can do a hand weeding or retill it or whatever you want to do. But the timing is the most important thing. Yeah.
Right on. Well, we'll be out there getting the timing just right with that net grass for our seed production project that we're doing. And again, if you're interested in jumping in with us, we'd love your help. Give us a call, 652-4118. You can use the same number to reserve your spot for a tree pruning workshop that's coming up next Saturday, the 11th of July. This is going to be taught by this can be taught by Mylon Rupert from Kauai Nursery and Landscaping, Paul Miller assisting, and that's going to be Saturday, the 11th of July. And as well, we want to let you know